WFNI, 93 WIBC, HD2, Indiana.
AJ
from the racing capital of the world.
Parker Wentz ready.
This is the talk of Gasoline Alley.
For our answer, winner of the
brought to you by the Indiana Union Construction Industry. Skilled on principle, union by choice.
Contact wins it by less than 1/10 of a second.
Now here's the historian of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, Donald Davidson and Kevin Lee.
Welcome to the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan, along with Donald Davidson, the historian of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. I am Kevin Lee. Before we continue, first, want to remind people that are flipping over for the Pacers broadcast right now. It is airing in Indianapolis on FM 107.5. Pre-game just now started with Michael Grady and Mark Boyle and Austin Crozier from Miami. Game number one will tip off in 35, 40 minutes, something like that. And after we're done tonight, at 9 o'clock, 1070 The Fan will also join. So the broadcast is airing on all the network stations throughout the state of Indiana that choose to carry the Pacers. And locally, FM 107.5. That's the same story for Friday night, the 8 to 9 time slot, only on FM 107.5, so we can continue to serve race fans and talk with Donald. So that's where you can find the Pacers tonight, and we'll chat about the history of the Indianapolis 500 coming up in the next hour. Tonight, hang on to your telephone calls. I decided we'll do a couple this way, so that way you're not waiting on hold for 30 minutes and I only get three calls in. We're going to roll through a lot of emails. I think I'm in triple figures, if not more. Probably a lot more than that. I have not counted, so I'm going to get to as many as we can tonight. And also, Donald, I think we should talk a little bit about what's going on this weekend. Obviously, tomorrow at the track is Firestone Indy Lights. That's the main activity on track. Most of us understand what's going to happen on Carb Day on Friday with the final IndyCar practice from 11 until 12, the Freedom 100 Lights race at 12:30. And then I know you'll be front stage for Poison coming up at 3:30 after the pit stop competition.
Absolutely.
So you're probably going to start camping out Friday morning and miss the Freedom 100. and then, of course, the Carb Night Burger Bash on Friday night, too. But Saturday is a big day, and I think a big day for listeners of this program that love the history of this race.
I've been asked a lot about the who's going to be doing autographs, the drivers. That's being done again. We've got about, I would say, in excess of 50 now returning veterans who have agreed to sign autographs. And obviously, I'm not going to run the entire list here, but I'll give you some high points. And I hope I don't offend anybody, but it's broken down into two sessions, and this is Saturday from 1 until 2:30, and then there'll be a break, and then 3 until 4:30, the next group comes in. So in the first group, we've got Johnny Rutherford and Ari Lyandike, and Ari Lyandike Jr., a lot of the ladies been asking about him. Jose Lee Garza has not been back for several years, and he is apparently going to be there. Jeff Brabham, Michael Chandler, and Bernard Jourdain was apparently got quite a bit of attention. Then we got Mel Kenyon. If I didn't mention Bobby Unser, he will be in the first group also. And then another dozen or more of fellows that didn't win, but the fans want their autographs, and they're just fan favorites. All right, the second group. We have Mario Andretti and Kenny Breck. Stefan Johansson is coming back again. So I know a lot of people missed him maybe the first time. Formula One driver, drove for Ferrari and McLaren. And,
I see him at several races around the country. He manages somebody.
He does, and I do not recall who that is. But anyway, he will be there. Hiro Mashusta, and then Eliseo Salazar, several locals, Joe Saldana. Bill Whittington is coming back, which there's...
I have a question in here about them that
I
we may get to
do.
At some point.
We've
saved that. Right. We get one or two every year.
And then Derek Daly wasn't able to make it last year. He does the parade downtown for Channel 8.
That's right.
And then he has other interests as well, such as a son driving in the 500-mile race, but he said that he plans to be back for the 3 to 4:30 session. Buzz Calkins, it goes on and on and on.
And Parnelli is going to be featured on Saturday. I haven't seen that schedule. I'll try to get that maybe for trackside tomorrow night.
There's a variety of things as well on the Thursday morning, we have an autograph session in the museum.
Oh, tomorrow morning. Okay.
With tomorrow at I'm trying to find my list here. Oh, I'm on the wrong day. Wait a minute. All right. Yes. From 11 until 12 tomorrow, we have Hall of Fame members will be signing autographs in the museum, and then there'll be some winners as well.
Mm.
And then 2:30 until 4, the vintage cars are on the track, running. And then Friday, the vintage cars will be out again, 8:30 till 9:45. And then from 10 o'clock until 11, there will be a reenactment of something that's taken place the night before, which is the induction of Sonny Meyer and Joe Leonard into the Hall of Fame. And Sonny will be there on Friday. And Paul Goldsmith, Joe can't come back, but his longtime friend, associate of back to the early 50s, Paul Goldsmith will do that. There is a book signing from 12 until 12:30. I know Parnelli's doing one. And then there's another one, a book that just came out that A.J. Watson, it features A.J. Watson's Roadster, which won the race in 1964, authored by your not always humble servant. And we'll be signing autographs from 12 until 12:30 on Friday. And probably I'm overdoing it here, but Saturday morning, then the vintage cars run again. This time it will be Roadsters only, 9:30 to 10:15. And the plan is that Parnelli Jones will pace them with his 1963 winning car, Calhoun.
Nice. Looks like it's $10 to get in on Legends Day on Saturday. Coors Light Carb Day is $20. And then I think general admission still starts. Well, I don't want to speak. I'm not certain of what general admission starts with as far as the race is concerned at this point. But IndianapolisMotorSpeedway.com, I'm sure, would have the answer for you. All right, again, hang on to your telephone calls for tonight. We're going to do some emails, and let's start with a question from Seth in Noblesville. He says, my earliest race memory is 91. It stuck with me more for the fact my mom was upset I left the race a Mears fan. What can you tell me about that race in 91?
Oh, golly, if you were sitting down in turn one, you got a thrill on consecutive laps. In the late stages, it appeared that that Michael Andretti may finally pull off a victory, which never was to happen. And there was a late race caution, and the pit stop shuffles were resolved with Michael leading, and Rick Mears was leading. Mm. That was it. Rick Mears was leading, and Michael was behind him, and they came down for the restart. And I don't know what lap this would be. It was like probably 180 something, mid 180s. And Michael got an outstanding start, and he passed Rick Mears on the outside going through the turn. Now, the fans hadn't seen that for a while, and admittedly it was after a restart, but they're still cooking by the time they get down to turn one. So an outside pass, I mean, actually passes in the turn were pretty unusual, but they would normally be underneath passes. I mean, typically in the last many years, you do the passing on the inside on the straightaway, and then you hopefully get up and clear the guy behind you or whoever it is behind you before you go into the turn. Well, anyway, so he does the outside pass, and I think the crowd were very impressed with that. And then on the next lap, coming down, I remember it was a very overcast day, and so here's Michael with a fairly substantial lead. And Rick Mears came out of nowhere when they came past the start-finish line. I mean, he would have been many car lengths back. It was rather like the passing of Buddy Lazier passing Davy Jones in 1986. But they went down into the turn, and Rick Mears went around the outside of Michael. And you could almost... The crowd went nuts.
Mm-hmm.
On the replay, I'm told that and I haven't watched this, but apparently there's a very subtle helmet movement. It's almost as if Michael's doing a double take, and you can see it with the helmet movement. And so it would be waxing lyrical to say that, you know, Mears had the race won from that point on and that, Michael was demoralized and so forth. But I think there may be some truth to that because to this day, and here we are more than 20 years later, Michael still can't believe that. I know that there's a couple of times I've been at like a press conference or something where that point was brought up. And as understated as he normally is, I mean, his head will roll back and his eyes will go wide and he will drop his head as if to say, I still can't believe that. But it was Mears now going for his fourth. And there was another yellow involving Mario. And by the time they got that that toe-in completed, the green came out and I think there was like four or five laps to the finish. And Rick has described that as the sprint to the checkered flag was a qualifying run. And because he said, four laps to go, I got Michael behind me, it's a qualifying run.
Yeah.
And so anyway, he won the race with Michael second. Probably there was a number of other interesting things that happened in that race. It had a very iconic front row with A.J. Foyt. When Mears was on the pole, Foyt was in the middle, and Mario Andretti was outside front row. That's about as iconic a front row as you can get. And there was also, from a personal point of view, the progress of Gordon Johncock with Johnny Rutherford in the booth doing the driver expert commentary. Watching a car that he had an opportunity to drive, and it was interesting to see how he didn't want to drive a Cosworth. In other words, he turned the car down. Al Unser turned it down. Rutherford turns it down, and I said, Johnny, you could have been in your 25th 500. He said, but it's a Cosworth. I'd be out there slugging all day. And so they got Johncock. I guess I'm telling the story now. Johncock's on a tractor in Michigan when Ron Hemelgarn calls and says, hey, get down and drive this car. And Johncock, everybody says, what? Johncock's going to drive? And so he qualified it outside of the last row. And then a day or two before the race, he got pneumonia or something very close. They had Johnny Parsons standing by to either relieve or even drive the car. And on race morning, I said, Johnny, you know, go down there. You could still get in that thing. It would be your ride. And he said, no. And as the race wore on, the attrition rate was very high. And on the very final lap, Johncock went from seventh to sixth. And I said, Johnny, you could have finished sixth. And at that point, he finally thought, But anyway, the historical part, I think, was Rick Mears winning his fourth 500. And then stamping himself as one of the all-time greats by that outside pass in turn one.
As soon as you brought this up, I can hear Jerry Baker in my ears with those two magnificent calls. Those are probably in the highlights of his career here at this place and very memorable calls. Good question. Thank you. Jeremy in Muncie, question, and it's emails only tonight. Hang on to your telephone calls. Jeremy asks, how have pit stops progressed through the years? Items replaced, equipment time needed, etc.
Well, okay, that's it used to be that the driver and riding mechanic in the very early days would do the stops themselves. I don't know if
without help.
I don't know. Now, in Grand Prix racing, the driver and the riding mechanic had to do it. Now, I'm not sure if they could have help or not. I rather think they could, but they definitely were. They would do the stops. So whether it was Ralph De Palmer or you know, whoever it was, they would either do it or be involved with it. In fact, and this is sort of maybe off on a little bit of a tangent, I was curious about the term crew, being on the crew, and that to me was sort of like a crew, a mechanic in the 50s. And I thought, I wonder if that's a World War II Navy term that's come into racing vernacular. Well, to cut a long story short and trace it back, the term crew was used before the war in racing for the driver and riding mechanic were the crew.
Okay.
But as far as the stops were concerned, they were fairly leisurely by modern standards. The driver and the riding mechanic would get out of the car while the work was done, and they could be 2 to 3 minute situations. The speeds sort of began to pick up in the 30s, but still the driver, in fact, there was a rule that the driver had to get out of the car on the pit stop. That rule was waived after 1946 when George Robson, the winner, did not get out on either stop, and there was a protest filed, and then finally they dropped it. And so from that point on, you didn't have
to.
So
up until 1947, the drivers got out on pit stops. I did not know that. Well, I knew they had at one point, but I didn't know that late.
But the stops took a lot longer. Well, even after it was no longer a rule, Maury Rose still did that every year. But the race would take...
Just get up and stretch your legs.
Because it would take about... the race was by 47, 48. You're talking about a 4.25-hour race. And you'd make one stop. Typically, the leader would make one stop. So... That was going from Chicago to Indianapolis and stopping at Kentland, which some of the old timers will remember.
And it was probably a minute and a half or so.
Oh, at least, yes. Yeah. So the driver would get out and take the stretch, get the drink, and go change his own goggles, and then.
And they weren't strapped in.
No, they didn't wear seatbelts.
There was no reason to stay in the car. It's easy to get out.
So then as the speeds picked up in the early 50s and then tire wear became an issue, then it was necessary to go to a second and a third stop. And so then when that happened, then they started, people like Frank Coon and Jim Travers and Lou Moore were trying to figure out what are some of the things that we can do. But we can save more time because, you know, a number of those races, the guy would win and it might be 4 minutes before second would come in. Mm-hmm. But as the margin of victory began to diminish, then they started thinking, well, you know, how can we save time? So the speed of the pit stops picked up. And I would say that mid-50s, you're probably talking like now maybe 35 to 40 second stops for the leaders. And I'll be able to sort of get on my soapbox about something here, but I am coming down the stretch. And that is that fairly standard from about 54, 53, 54 on, was fairly standard now that the leaders would make three stops. Well, in 1963, Jim Clark and Dan Gurney came with the Lotuses, which ran production engines with carburetors and running on gasoline. And Clark made a fairly leisurely stop, but he only made one. Parnelli Jones made three stops, and there was no minimum. And Clark made one stop. That got a lot of people's attention. How do you save time making pit stops? Don't make any. And so there was thinking that for 64, some people may try and go at the route without a stop, or at the very least, they could get by on one. Well, all of that changed. But anyway, in 1965, and this is the point that I want to make, and I'm almost done with the question, which I appreciate having the opportunity to answer, and that is that I believe they were using a force-fed refueling on some of them at least, and that from 65 on, it was gravity feed only. And then also there were two mandatory stops put in. Now, the Wood Brothers were brought in by Ford Motor Company to do Jim Clark and Bobby John's pit stops for the Lotus Ford team in 1965. And to this day, the Wood Brothers get all kinds of praise for having revolutionized the pit stops and gone up and shown the Indianapolis people how to do it. Well, that story's grown legs. They never changed a tire. They did two stops, and their stops were, I think the first one was, either the first one was 22 seconds, and the second one was 25 seconds, or it was the other way around, but the two stops, 25 and 22. And so the story has been told by former driver who became a commentator and other people from down south, that the Wood Brothers pit stops in 65, the stops on the two cars were less elapsed time for the four stops than any single stop made by any of the participants. It was absolute baloney. But in 1962, and I'm not making this up, now, and remember that they did a 22-second and a 25-second stop. In 1962, Roger Ward won the race, A.J. Watson, and the stops were 19 seconds, 22 seconds and 19 seconds, and there was at least one wheel changed on every stop. So they did fuel and tires in 19, 22, and 19. And even Foyt in 64, now he didn't, he went the distance without a wheel change, but Frank Catania, who was George Bignotti's fuel man, and I think he did two stops, 22 seconds and 22 seconds. So all this business about the Wood Brothers coming up is just, you know, really baloney. And however, I've talked to Glenn and Leonard Wood both, and they chuckle about it because they never made any. I mean, there's great stories about them on how they learned how to do the stops, because don't forget, they were dump can guys then, and still today, those are the only pit stops they ever did with a fuel hose. But it's funny when they get all this credit and all they, you know, they never changed a wheel. And but all of the claims were made by other people. It's the stories that grow legs. When you talk to them about it, they just chuckle.
Jeremy, thanks for the question. More email questions for Donald Davidson coming up. It's the talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan. Don't forget, if you're looking for the Pacers, they are on their pregame show right now. Game doesn't tip for another 20 minutes or so. FM 107.5 has Indianapolis coverage of the Pacers and Heat pregame show. Game one in Miami underway right now. Stay with us. Right back.
The Talk of Gasoline Alley is brought to you by the Indiana Union Construction Industry. Skilled on principle, union by choice.
We continue the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan. If you were looking for the Pacers, they are airing right now. Still pregame coverage underway with Michael Grady, Mark Boyle, and Austin Crozier in Miami. That's on FM 107.5. We'll get back to the simulcast, and 1070 The Fan will join us when we're done tonight at 9 o'clock. Donald, you had another pit stop thought.
Yes, I did. The fact that when you go through the 70s and 80s, the pit stops were typically probably, you know, 18 to 20 seconds. And routinely, when they'd come in for fuel, they would check the tires and change only the ones that needed changing. So you would get right side tires only, or the two rears, or three. Normally, the left front would go through the whole race without a change, but they would have a chance to quickly look and see if it was okay. Then when the speeds picked up and the fuel tanks were downsized, the pit stops then automatically became quicker. And then rather than changing the tires and doing whatever you needed to do until the fuel guy was complete, now the fuel guy was done in a hurry. And so there wasn't enough time to do that decision on whether to change it. So now they automatically, I think, and you'd know this better because you work the races, but I think that when a car comes in to make a fuel stop, it's an automatic all four.
It's always four. Yeah, it's just as quick to do four as it is to do one, because you've got one for each. And you don't have to manually jack it up like they do in NASCAR. When did they get away from manually jacking up? When did they have the hydraulic jacks under the car?
Well, there's not an easy answer to that one either. But just the timing, I think that 10 seconds is probably a slow stop now.
It is. It's not. Yeah, it's slow. You can do tires in 6+ seconds. Usually they're still waiting on the fuel.
Waiting on the fuel guy.
I would say anything under 8 is still good. 9 is not bad. 10 is where you're losing some time. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But as far as the onboard jacks, the first set of onboard jacks were installed on a car that didn't make the race in 1958, Troy Ruttman. And then in 59, A.J. Watson put them on the cars that finished first and second with Watson and, Roger Wood and Jim Rathman. And I remember for a number of years, and I loved Sam Posey, as opposed to a lot of people, I loved Sam Posey's work, but he made the statement several times that was a Roger Penske innovation. It was a Watson. Watson got that from Eddie Kusmer, and so late 50s. Then for a while, they didn't do it. In fact, George Bignotti, and I was... was touting this book about the 64 winning car. When Bignotti said that car had onboard jacks, and he said for 64, the tire development was such that we figured that we weren't going to have to change any tires, and we could save 25 pounds if we took that unit out.
Oh, okay.
And so so they were on there for a while, and it was pneumatic, where you just stick the hose in the side, and compressed air would shove the, like a tripod usually, or four prongs that would come out to lift the car up. And I think that they were in, they were out, and then in again, and I'm not even sure what they do now.
It's air, yeah.
Okay, is it driver operated or is
oh
it
no
a,
they stick an air hose in right. the side. There are six guys allowed over the wall, one mm-hmm. for each tire, one fueler, and one mm-hmm. is jacking the car up with the air hose. Okay. Were there limitations on the number of people over the wall back in the day? You have any idea when that started, when they had a limitation?
The number has changed, but that's gone back for, golly, I don't know, 50, 60 years.
That they've had a limit?
Yes.
Yeah,
but
okay.
But what typically the rules were rather complicated. They would say, only six over the wall, including the driver. And I thought, well, why wouldn't you just say five?
Yeah. Well, I guess then somebody said, well, wait a minute, is the driver not over the wall? He's on the team. So.
And then, of course, there was ways around that, because the fellow that would hand the drink would be on the other side of the wall, and this pole would come out with a Dixie cup.
You have many more than six guys involved in a pit stop, because you have another six that are leaning over the wall. They're handing them tires, and, mm-hmm. and they'll bring them back and hand them back, and you've got the lollipop guy, and you've mm-hmm. got a drink guy. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more going on there. Good question back from the last segment, Jeremy. Carl's question is, with Buddy Lazier returning, I recall Jacques Lazier leading the race one year. Other than the Unzers, have any other brother combinations both led laps?
Louis and Gaston Chevrolet. Dick Rathman never led the race, I don't think. He was on the pole, but I don't think he ever led. So that's a good question. I've got to think about all the brothers. Would Pancho Carter and Johnny Parsons? I'm not sure if Johnny Parsons led a couple. Maybe not. Boy, that's embarrassing. Let's see. Hal Robson didn't. I've got to think about all the brothers. There's a double calculation here. Jerry Sneva never led. Roger Mears never led. That's all I can think of. Jeff Andretti never led. This is hard.
Bettenhausen's?
Gary led, but Tony Jr. did not.
Okay.
The father did, but that's not what we're talking about.
Yeah.
All right, I'll give that some thought.
Okay.
No, I can't think
we'll
of
that. We'll keep thinking on that
question.
One.
I mean, you don't think of Jacques Lazier as having led a couple of laps.
Darren asks, he says, the Speedway used to shoot aerial bombs or fireworks off at the start of the race. When did this start? When did it stop? Was there a reason?
I don't know when that started. Maybe back to the very beginning, because there was the military presence. There used to be a lot more military presence. The Indiana National Guard policed the event, and the one that remains. There used to be a number of bombs that went off on race morning. There was the gates open, and then I think they did a bomb on every hour, and then as it got closer to the race, there was like a half hour and a quarter hour. But the cluster that would go off, I don't know when that finally stopped exactly, but I was not unhappy when it stopped, because it used to fright the life out of me. For a number of years, in the first few broadcasts I was involved, I was not in the booth throughout the race. I was out on what I call the veranda, and Sid would wave me in when it was time. I would be listening to the radio.
Was it on
a transistor radio?
Pretty crowded booth.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so he would.
And we still have that.
he would look at me and then point and say, "Have you got anything?" Or else just wave me in.
Yeah.
So anyway, I'm outside when the thing would start, and so here they come, and there was the crescendo of noise, and they would go down, and then you would get this bang, 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 and you think, "Oh, what happened?" Bang, 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 and it was the aerial bombs going off. I thought, "Golly, I wish they wouldn't do that." I would say that went all the way through Joe Quinn, who was it was a safety director thing. And I think it may have continued on even through Jack O'Neill and Bob O'Neill, one time head of the Indiana State Police. I think he may have continued it on, and it may have been Robert McAteer, who was a big time Marine. I think he may have been the one that did away with it, but when it was stopped, I've had a lot of people ask me about it. Personally, I did not miss it at all. It used to frighten me every year. So we're now just down to the one bomb, and I'd like to...
That's what I was going to ask you about next.
Well,
the one when the gates open. Is
yes.
that what you're talking about? Because the drivers hate that one, and anybody stayed on the grounds.
But
does it go off at 5 or 6?
It's whatever. Well,
whenever
whatever
the gates
open.
Yeah,
it was... who was it? Was it Kevin Harvick? Or no?
Jimmy Johnson last year, I think, was complaining.
All right, then.
So they do it for the Brickyard, too.
Jimmy Johnson, that's right. Yeah, well, I don't know that they always did, but they did it this year.
Yeah.
And Jimmy Johnson was very unhappy, and I thought, well, you know, you don't, if you, you, number one, it's tradition, and number two, you don't have to sleep on the grounds. If you've been allowed to bring your motorhome to the infield and that bothers you, well, you know, maybe you shouldn't do it. But
I'd be annoyed too. I'd be annoyed too.
Well, I live in the area, and I'm not at the track, but I am awake. And you get boom, boom. And I've laughed about it, so this is not a fresh line that I'm doing here, but I just thought I've expressed for many, many years how effective that is, because it's actually a signal to everybody at all the numerous gates, it's time to open the gates. So I'm saying that, you know, the modern thinking now is let's install $20 million worth of computer equipment so we can have some kind of a signal.
And back in now they can do walkie-talkies, but back in the day, they didn't have that. And even now...
But what's more effective than
there's
bang.
Nothing. With modern technology, there is nothing more effective than that. It's open, right. Come on in.
Right.
And it is tradition. Darren had a second question that I think is interesting, too. He says, Dario Franchitti appeared on the cover of the program last year prior to the race, then went on to win. Do you know if that's happened before? How many times when the driver has appeared on that year's program and won that year's race?
I don't... The thinking was that this is a brand new thing for participants to appear on the cover. And if you do not have the program this year...
It could happen again this year.
Well,
two opportunities.
Yes, if you open out the fold. But just the very fact that participants are on the cover, on the cover that you see till you do the fold out, it's Foyt, Rick Mears and Al Unser, the four-time winners, in casual
outfits. Oh, and then the fold
outfits.
Is the other two.
And then you fold out, and then it's got the living three-time winners, which is Bobby Unser, Castro Neves, Franchitti, and Johnny Rutherford.
Okay.
And it just gives me goosebumps just to look at those shots, and there's a poster of it, and so it's come up recently. Well, we put participants on the cover. What a unique concept.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for the question, Darren. More questions via email tonight. We've already received them. If you send something in, it's probably not going to get there tonight. I'm going to try to go through the ones that we've already received, and we'll get to more coming up in a moment. If you're looking for the Pacers, we'll join that at 9 o'clock, but it's on in Indianapolis right now, FM 107.5, not too far away from tip for game number one, Eastern Conference Finals in Miami. This is the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan.
The Talk of Gasoline Alley is brought to you by the Indiana Union Construction Industry, skilled on principle, union by choice.
This is the Talk of Gasoline Alley, 1070 The Fan. The Pacers broadcast is airing right now on FM 107.5. We'll join that coming up when we're done at 9 o'clock. Email-only edition tonight. Questions for Donald. And our next is from Eric in St. Paul, Minnesota. What's the longest time between being a rookie and winning the 500? I think it took them the longest time. Most races, you could do it either way, most races or longest years if somebody missed some time, maybe for World War II.
Yes, that's
or
right.
Or something.
That would be a toughie between, and then...
I've got a guess.
Well, could you have passed your rookie test and not made it? Or are we talking about actually starting the race?
I'll let you go at it either direction you want. Then. I think the simplest would be from making the race.
Well, okay, then Sam Hanks, and I'd have to... to talk this one through a little bit, but Sam Hanks started the race in 1940 and won it in 1957.
Okay, so for years, he missed, obviously, 40, no race during the war, so
correct.
For years, that's going to be tough to beat. My guess was Rutherford, but that's
starts.
Not going to be that 17 years, but he might have him in starts. What would Rutherford have been, about 13, 12?
He went 63, I think it was his 10th, because he went from 63 to 74, and that's 11 years, but it's 12 races. But he wasn't in the 66 race, so
okay.
I think Rutherford's would have been his 11th start. Let's see. I've got to. But that's a very good. That's a good guess because I mean, you know, he hadn't finished the race till he won it. But others. All right. I'd have to. I would almost guess it was Sam Hanks. Jim Rathman was a rookie in 49 and won it in 60, so that's 11 years. That's 7 or 6 short of Sam. See, so Roger Ward, Foyt won early on. I think that's got to be it.
When was John Cox's rookie year? I don't think he went as long as Rutherford.
John Cox was a rookie in 65 and he won it in 73. So that's 8 years. It would have been his ninth race.
I'm not cheating. I'm looking just looking through a list of winners.
Okay, we could do it that way.
To see if any other strike my fancy as someone who might be in that category. Not Jim Rathman. Single digits.
49 to 60.
Okay, so Sneva, 8 or 9, 10.
Sneva took his rookie test, if you want to do it both ways. Sneva took the rookie test in 73 and didn't start, but he started in 74 and won in 83, and he had a straight run, so that was his 10th start.
Okay.
So I think it's got to be Sam Hanks in terms of years.
All right, that's our best guess. Thank you. This question is from Davis Brewer. He says, it always makes me happy to see Chucky selling the Indianapolis Star. How long has Chucky been at the Speedway doing that?
I do not know that. For years, going through the garage area. So I can't give you the year. He wrote a book, which I have not read, but there's a couple of Chucky stories. And the fact is that the drivers, I mean, he would go through the garage area selling the Star, and that drivers would give him $10, $20, and he was befriended by a bunch of them. He had this old tricycle, and at some point the drivers got together and bought him a new one. Anyway, my favorite Chucky story of all, in fact, this would rank up amongst my favorite stories about the Speedway. One year, I do not remember the year, but it was sort of like early 90s, and Fittipaldi was running late. Now, they didn't do the green room and the driver introduction in those days, which is another thing that's changed. It used to be that it was up to the drivers to come out, so I'm going to digress slightly here and say that sometimes you would see the rookies or even the veterans out there very early, not dressed. They would either not appear or they'd be earlier and then gone, and then it would be like 30 minutes before the start, and a lot of the drivers hadn't appeared yet. And it seemed like that you would bow your head for the invocation, and then when you looked up, the veterans had materialized at the very last minute. Mm. That was the thing, to work it out. Where's the ideal time that you can come out of the garage area and get to your car without, you know, having to get through a sea of people? Well, of course, that's changed now. But before it did, one year, Fittipaldi was running late back in the garage area. And there was sort of almost like a panic, like, you know, hey, they're going to fire the engines in 10 minutes or something like that. And Chuck happened to be coming through the garage area. And I don't know whether he made the offer or Fittipaldi flagged him down. But Chuck gave him the ride out.
Trailed him on his bicycle.
He got up on the back of the tricycle with the feet astride behind Chuck, holding onto his shoulders. And Chuck rode out through Gasoline Alley and all the guards blowing whistles and everything.
That's great.
And he went down into the pit lane and then rode north down to where Fittipaldi's car was.
Nice. Good story. All right, more to come. Questions for Donald via email tonight. Pacers underway over on FM 107.5, game one of the conference finals. We join in a few minutes here on 1070 The Fan.
The Talk of Gasoline Alley is brought to you by the Indiana Union Construction Industry, skilled on principle, union by choice.
This is the Talk of Gasoline Alley, 1070 The Fan. The Pacers are on right now, FM 107.5. If you're looking for them, and we'll join in here coming up in just a few minutes when we are done. I'm Kevin Lee with Donald Davidson. Email questions only tonight. Alan in Wichita has emailed this a couple of times, so we'll sneak it in. Would like you to profile 30s-era driver Gus Schrader.
Oh, I don't know that we've had him, have we?
I don't recall.
I don't think so. Gus Schrader was from Iowa. What was the town? I'm stuck on that one. Anyway, his forte was IMCA. I think I'd have to count it up. I think he was the IMCA champion 8 times. Hmm. His principal, he might have been born in Des Moines. He had a presence in Des Moines for many years. And anyway, Emory Collins, who was a Canadian who lived in Lemars of Iowa, was his closest rival. But a lot of people would swear that Gus Schrader never drove in the Indianapolis 500, and he did in 1932. It was his only appearance there, and he drove a V16 Miller for Harry Miller, and I think he crashed or he was out very early. I think he had like 7 laps in, and that was his only 500. But anyway, he was the darling, if you like, of J. Alex Sloan, who was the great promoter of IMCA. Which was a dirt track. They did all the county and state fairs. It was suggested that maybe not all of their races were above boards, and whether that's fair or whether it's not, and whether it was true at some times and not others, we'll never really know. But Gus Schrader and Emory Collins were the favorites, and they pretty much won all the races. But they would go to all these joints in Iowa and North Dakota and South Dakota, and then make a swing down through the South. They would go to Shreveport, Louisiana, but pretty much it was a sort of like a corn belt circuit, and they would go in and have a very flamboyant announcer, and they'd be, every time they went out, they were breaking the world's dirt track record and all this kind of thing. But anyway, so Schrader, I think he won the championship 8 times, and then dramatically was fatally injured at the end of the 1941 season, October the 22nd of 41, I believe was the date, Shreveport, Louisiana. And the word was that he was going to retire at the end of the year, and whether that was true or not, we don't know. But anyway, he was fatally injured in what conceivably was going to be his last planned race. He had the place in Des Moines, but he would winter in California. So he lived in Los Angeles during the winter. And a very good friend of his was Ronald Reagan. And that's no baloney, as we say, because Ronald Reagan had been on the air as Dutch Reagan in Des Moines on call letters that are escaping me at the moment. But I've actually been on this. I've done stuff on that station. And so there is a photograph that actually is in the Speedway archives that are a little misleading, because it's got Gus Schrader sitting in a sprint car and Ronald Reagan sitting on the right rear tire. Well, it was in Los Angeles, and it was a photo op after he had gone out there and become an actor and well-known on radio. But anyway, just the final thing is that Schrader was assisted by a couple of things, not the least excellent equipment, but he had a Miller that was a 318 cubic inch, which was big, and also IMCA allowed knobby tires, which meant that they gave fantastic traction on dirt tracks, and so they could throw rooster tails. AAA and USAC didn't allow knobbies.
Okay, good question. Thank you. I think we can sneak this one in. When's the last time a USAC Sprint Champ car driver qualified for the poll? His guess, Poncho Carter.
There's an asterisk by Tony Stewart, who was the second fastest qualifier.
He said qualified for the poll, not started on the poll.
Okay, so that would be Poncho, because Tony, sort of was moved over.
Yeah.
The trivia question, which I'm having fun with right now, is when is the last time a driver won the poll who had won a USAC sprint car feature, at least one.
Yeah, and it's and obviously
the
Ed.
Is, the answer and, is 2013 with Ed Carpenter.
And before that?
Oh, before that.
Still probably Poncho.
Probably Poncho, yeah. To actually win the poll.
Very cool. Very cool. Can't wait for the race. We'll continue to talk about the history of the race for 2 more nights leading up to it, tomorrow night at 8 o'clock as well. Thanks to all the emails. I've still got a large stack that I've already printed off that we're going to effort to get in tomorrow night as well. Phone calls later in the week. I know Friday night's going to be all phone calls, so we look forward to that as well, and some phone calls after the race on Sunday as well. Donald, thank you. We'll see you tomorrow
thank
night
you, Kevin. Yep.
At 8 o'clock. And, again, FM 107.5 has had the Pacers. Coming up next, we join them. Thanks so much. Tomorrow night, join us. Trackside, me and Kurt will be at the Grill at Geist. And Oriel Servia, Dennis Reinbold, Robbie Buell will join us tomorrow night there at 7. We'll be there a little bit before that as well. Come and join us. 21 and over, by the way, for that. And it's all ages welcome for the Carb Night Burger Bash coming up on Friday night at 96th Street Steak Burgers. Thanks for joining us tonight on 1070 The Fan.